Hi, and welcome to the Macro Show. We talk macro, and you wonder, did the Fed really beat the big banks? We've got that. We've got economic data. We've got regional Fed surveys to look at, treasury auction stuff. We've got bond things. Of course, bonds are up today again, so we're going to celebrate any victory we can. We'll look at, probably even look at some charts on that. Let's start out with, how did the Fed beat the big banks? I mean, did they really do it with this SLR rule? And I think they did. Let's take a look at some of what's going on here, because one thing I want to encourage you, you know, is when you're doing macro, you got to think through, like, okay, what's the motivation on this person's side and what's the motivation on the other person's side? In this case, we've got the Fed on one side, big banks on the other. We know the big banks lobbied the Fed to keep the exemption in place. They didn't get it. So what did the Fed know? Or maybe the Fed doesn't care. Let's look at the circumstantial information. Now, let's just first identify this enhanced supplementary leverage ratio, ESLR, only applies to all the U.S. holding companies identified as global systematically important banking organizations, or GSIBs. Now, I did mention in a prior show that I didn't know exactly which ones, because they mix them together with some non-U.S. holding companies. So here are 30 as of November 2020, the 30 GSIBs, and you know, you can just kind of pick out the U.S. ones with high probability: Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, B of A, BNY, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, maybe State Street, UBS, Wells Fargo. So there's probably in this list about 10 U.S. GSIBs. Now, what is this big deal about this rule? Like, why were the banks throwing such a fit? Because remember, under the ESLR, they have to maintain a leverage ratio over 5%, which is a 3% requirement plus a buffer of 2%, because they're GSIBs. And what does that get them? It means they avoid limitations on capital distributions, think dividends, and certain discretionary bonus payments. Now, you know, the big banks love discretionary bonus payments. So how do we know that potentially this is really was a nothing burger to begin with because of how the Fed handled it? Now, do you think the Fed, before Powell made his decision to let the exemption expire, do you think he had his mountain of PhD economists, his analysts, all those people that are employed at the Fed, do you think he had some people maybe run some estimates? Yeah, he probably did. And he probably reviewed them and realized that there isn't really anything here. There isn't a problem, because if there was a problem, let's just pretend. What if there is a problem? What could he have done? He could have said, hey, I'm going to do maybe a 3-month extension, right? He could have extended the exemption for a little bit longer. He could have done a phase in and said, hey, you know, due to the banks absorbing all these treasury securities that we've been issuing and through QE, we need to, you know, phase this in. He could have done that as well. Or what else could he have done? Let's say he gets the report and says, wow, there's too many of these banks are going to be penalized. He could have just issued a blanket statement out and said, look, I'm going to suspend all share buybacks and bonuses for, say, a quarter. And he could go that on a rolling quarter and then behind the scenes tell the banks, look, get your tier one capital number up. Get this fixed. So that way we're not going to call certain banks. We're going to penalize all banks. So there's a number of things he really could have done here. And, you know, how do we know? How else do we know? Well, were there any disruptions from this? Well, no. I mean, not at all. I mean, look at treasury yields, right? They've, since the announcement, they're down. Remember, they're supposed to only go up because the banks are going to dump massive amounts of treasury securities. What about bank stocks? Where are they? Where's XLF on here somewhere? Oh, it's up here. Oh, they went down too, because perhaps the market realizes that when push comes to shove, the banks are going to choose to back off those risky loans, curtail them somehow, as we've talked. And what about from the bank's perspective? Have you heard any announcement, right? I mean, if you were really mad at the Fed and you were the bank CEO, wouldn't this be a great opportunity for you to come out and say, oh, by the way, shareholders, we're going to be forced to suspend our dividends because the Fed did not extend this rule? Didn't see that either. The reality is, the banks knew when this exemption went into place that 12 months later it was going to be gone, and they had time to adjust to it. So likely the circumstantial information says everything's okay and the Fed has a victory in their pocket. All right, let's get on to some economic data. All right, we'll go back to Tuesday as we continue our hunt for inflation in the economic data. Bank of Japan core CPI, member core excludes food and energy, negative 0.2%. That in year over year, that is deflationary. So we continue to see deflation coming out of Japan. Let's look at some other data we've got in here. Oh, Redbook. Now this is really interesting to me. So the year over year Redbook rose from 8.5 to 9.4%. Now that's great, right? It's the month over month. Check this out. For the, you know, remember when 3 weeks ago when this number came out, it was minus 18.1, and you had to think, well, that's got to be an anomaly in the data. There's just no way that, you know, that can be real. And then what happened the next week? Minus 17.9. And then this week, printed this week from last week, minus 17.6. I kind of now wonder when the stimulus checks hit, this number should go to the plus, right? That was how we would think of this from a macro perspective, is there's some major problems. If, you know, one number could just be a one-off. 3 consecutive weeks of nearly minus 18% tells you consumers, well, they're not spending. But we'll see what the difference makes when the stimulus checks start showing up in the data, which ought to be in next week's Redbook. LSE new home sales were down 18% in February. This is being billed as a weather-related issue. Obviously, we will see. Or perhaps this is a signal to peak in the housing market. Maybe this is what we're seeing in the mortgage application data, which we'll look at. Perhaps rates are now too high. Or maybe people are becoming uncertain about this economic recovery. Let's take a look at the Richmond Fed Manufacturing Index. Now, you know, I do like these regional Fed surveys. I think there's a lot of value in them, and they're really easy to get. So let's see. The 5th District said manufacturing activity expanded in March. We know that because the index rose from 14 in February to 17 in March. So it lists a sharp increase in shipments. It should be no surprise. Everything's backed up at ports and trucks all over the place. And then new orders and employment held steady. So let's take a look at some of the survey results. And just to help you, you know, when you look at these reports, particularly when you're comparing, you know, an ISM or a market PMI report versus the regional feds are done a bit differently. So you always just want to double check each index equals the percentage of responding firms reporting an increase minus the percentage reporting a decrease. So, and then we'll look at the prices paid. So what do we see here on shipments, right? 22% of firms are reporting and a problem there in current. We know this is a slowdown. Volume of new orders up slightly, backlog of orders up slightly, capacity utilization, this is good. This is how much of your factory is used, up slightly. Vendor lead time at 61. So 61% of firms are reporting the vendor lead times are going up. Local business conditions are improving. Capital expenditures are improving. So overall, this is a good report. Finished good inventories down, right? So that is showing to a demand problem. So that's good, right? If finished good inventories are falling, that means they're selling them. Raw material inventories down. That's obviously a supply chain issue. Equipment and software spending is up. That might be an automation area. I'd be interested to see if that turns out to be an automation. Number of employees, 22% of firms reporting an increase in employees, 26% reporting an increase in wages. There's never the correct availability of skills needed, and the average work week was up. And remember in the last payroll report, we saw the average work week went down. So this is, you know, a plus for workers. Now, how about price trends? Now, these are expressed in as a percentage change on an annualizer year-over-year basis. So prices paid up 6.15% from this time last year. But notice this margin squeeze, prices received up 3.52% from this time last year. So what you're seeing is manufacturers are taking it on the margin, meaning this is going to hurt their profitability. So we'll probably start seeing this in the earnings reports when they come out for the first quarter. All right, we had a two-year note auction. The market was a bit nervous going into that. I promised you it would be nervous, really nervous going into tomorrow's seven-year. But what's some notable things about the two-year note is the low yield printed at 0.05%. That's pretty incredible. Overall, this is a good auction. The bid to cover was above its six-month average. And direct bidders, domestic bidders, actually increased their takeover last month. So it was a good auction. Let's go on. Producer prices in South Korea. Up 2%. You know, this isn't really an issue. I mean, producer prices can go up, but if they can't pass it on to the consumer, it doesn't really matter. Let's see. Looking at our friends down under in Australia, manufacturing PMI, these are all the preliminary numbers now, increased very slightly over last month. So we're seeing a continued increase in the manufacturing sector in Australia. Services sector also rose. So that's positive. How about Japan corporate services price index deflationary at -0.1%? And looking at Japan, the manufacturing PMI increased very slightly. Remember, 50 is no change, so 52 is just a very slight increase. Services PMI continued contraction so far, preliminary basis at 46.5. Let's go into the Wednesday data. We've got core CPI, member core, excluding food and energy. Great Britain slowed from 1.4 to 0.9, so it's disinflationary. How about core PPI? It went from 1.5 and slowed to 1.4, so you feel a little margin squeeze there on the output side of the core PPI. Great Britain CPI went from 0.7, so disinflationary, down to 0.4%, and input prices in Great Britain are going up at 2.6%, but remember, output prices are going slowed to 1.4%. So you're seeing margin squeeze there in the factories. Now let's go on to some of the Eurozone. We'll just look at the composite PMIs. We've got France, again, all preliminary data, unchanged, 49.5, no change there over the prior month. How about Germany, continued expansion at 56.8? So definitely better than slight expansion there. How about the Eurozone market composite is 52.5, means just very slight improvement over last month. Great Britain, composite PMI, 56.6. So, you know, better than slight expansion there over the prior month, which was unchanged. So the prior month didn't budge at all. And so that's a plus for Great Britain. But with Europe going back into lockdowns, the market didn't get too excited about these numbers at all. Let's go into the U.S. data for today. We've got mortgage applications down again. And so you start looking at the housing market, and people say it's super bullish. But, you know, you got to go back and you see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 negative weeks out of the last 9 with 2 positive prints. So it's telling you, you know, when you're in a liquidity trap, what do you expect people to do when rates go up? Reject them. You're seeing that right there. Let's take a look at durable goods new orders for February. Was expected to increase. We went from 3.5% in January to -1.1% in February. This is not year over year. This is month over month. How about excluding food and energy? Went from 1.6 to -0.9. So these are falling. That's not what you expect to see. Getting into the U.S. market. Composite PMI. Remember, composite's a blend of manufacturing and services. So we went from 59.5, which is, you know, a decent expansion, slowed to 59.1. So, you know, what the market is saying is, look, the U.S. manufacturing services sector are still expanding, just at a little bit slightly slower pace. How about the manufacturing PMI went from 58.6 to 59? So still seeing an expansion in the U.S. manufacturing sector and the services sector. You know, you see it virtually unchanged, 59.8 to 60. So we're still seeing an expansion in the services sector in according to the market data. Oil inventories and crude oil was up 1.912. More importantly to me, and I talked to Tracy, chatted with Tracy Chuchart. If you are interested in oil and you are on Twitter and you're not following @ChaiGirl, you're making a big mistake. You need to follow her. In her report today on the EIA data, she mentioned that refinery utilizations were pretty much back where they were And just before the big free snowstorm in Texas, it run into low 80s, and we're heading into refinery maintenance season. So these numbers should be, you know, pretty stable here. So from a macro perspective, what are we going to be interested in seeing is the demand from this. So we know the refiners are going to be running at a little bit lower rate than normal because of maintenance season. So we want to see how does this translate into demand. And what's interesting here is distillate stocks were up 3.8 million barrels, and gasoline inventory is not up much, but 203,000. Then we had the five-year note auction. Market got nervous going into this. It wasn't billed as that great, mainly because of the yield, the low yield wasn't really, there wasn't a lot of demand. And here's the thing, there isn't a lot of demand for the five-year. And guess what? There's even less demand for the seven-year coming tomorrow. I guarantee you the market's going to be jittery going into that. The bid to cover was right, you know, pretty much right on a six-month average. But what's interesting, again, domestic bidders took a little bit more than normal. So that's a sign that perhaps money managers or not, you know, pension funds aren't that confident or about the economy, or they just like these higher yields. Let's see, do we have anything else? No. All right, let's talk about the stimulus check. I thought this was great. This is from Bloomberg. How respondents in the Bloomberg Morning Consult survey said they mostly spend it. What are we gonna look for? Inflation, right? That's what we're looking for. So 34% of people said they save their checks. Now what happens when checks get deposited in the banking, in the commercial banking system? Well, they get turned into reserves. And how do they do that? How do banks do that? They buy bonds. So 30% said they're gonna spend it on food, which is perhaps telling you that, you know, household finances aren't that strong, or perhaps they're, you know, looking down the road and saying, look, we're uncertain, so we're gonna use this to buy food. I doubt it means they're gonna be entirely eating out. Maybe it does. 22% on housing. We know a lot of people are behind on rents and mortgages. 18% to credit card debt. 2% to student loans. What happens when you pay down on your debt? That destroys money. That is deflationary. 11% on home improvement. You know, healthcare, yeah, who knows? Clothing, schools, I know at least here in California are starting to reopen. But you don't see a ton of discretionary expenses. You know, home improvement would be one, vacation, electronics, education. I mean, it's not a ton of discretionary spending, but far more non-discretionary. And, you know, one thing I don't see in here is higher gas prices. You know, that should be on there. All right, let's get into some bond stuff, because perhaps we know, or at least an idea of what is going on, why we have this overnight selling, right? There's a song, why do the monsters come out at night? Well, maybe our buddy Travis can drop some lyrics. That Travis would be the Earl of Crayon on why do these sellers come out at night? So Zero Hedge ran this piece based on what they found from Morgan Stanley. And they said 80%, 85% of the cumulative decline in treasury futures occurred during the overnight session, right? We've talked about how it's mostly in the overnight trading. And they're pointing out that Japan is mostly responsible for the dump, which triggered people selling into the European session. Now, this is pretty interesting, and they have good reason to believe that selling from Japan won't last into April, because the fiscal year in Japan ends on March 31st. And that point, liquidation of non-yen bond holdings should stop, if not reverse, at some point between April to June. So the question is why? Well, Morgan Stanley goes on to say that Japanese commercial banks hold a large number of equity shares. So this is not something, you know, U.S. banks do. And the Nikkei 225 equity index put in its best fiscal year performance in decades. In other words, for the commercial banks, the income from bond holdings wasn't necessary to make the year a successful one. In fact, perhaps it was going to hurt their numbers. So consider it one massive pension rebalance ahead of the March 31st fiscal year. Only this one was among commercial banks. So what does that mean? Well, with a new fiscal year, so here's what I want you to think about this, right? You're in sales, right? And your boss says, here's, you know, your year-end target, right? And, or your team or your company, here's your target. And as you get closer to target, you're short. So what do? You do everything possible, right? You call up your customers, you offer them discounts and things, and you move that inventory because you want to hit those numbers and get your bonuses. Maybe you just keep your job. And so you think, okay, what's going on with these commercial banks in Japan? They want to hit their numbers. So what perhaps they did was sell treasury securities to make their bottom line look a little bit better. And what's interesting here is of Hornbach of Morgan Stanley adds that this was no longer necessary to take the risk that bond yields would keep rising, thereby subjecting their bond portfolios to capital losses in the last quarter of the fiscal year. At the same time, with the new fiscal year, right, if you're in sales, you know how this goes, comes the new revenue targets. And unless banks have confidence in the Nikkei 225, continue to rise, the much more attractive carry and expected roll down in the treasury market will be very appealing, according to the Morgan Stanley strategist. All right, let's take a look at this last slide, and we'll grab a few charts. Is we've got the consensus sentiment toward U.S. Treasuries against the 10-year Treasury yield. The yield is shown inverted. So we have massive bearish sentiment against the bond market. And when that happens, that means yields are going to fall. So let's take a quick look at some charts. Why did we see bond prices move so quickly today? Well, one reason is there's this gap here. Now, this is an overnight gap, occurs during overnight trading. And if we zoom in a little bit and then we go over here to vol profile, what you see is there wasn't a lot of shares traded over the last 30 days in this range. And if we even zoom in, let's see, to 10 days, you see there's very little between where this gap was formed and now. So when there's not a lot of shares there, think of this as speed bumps, right? And here's a speed bump in a parking lot, and you're driving in between them, and there's no speed bump. So what do? You can accelerate through them, and that's exactly what we saw here. Now, the big speed bump for bond prices is going to be up here, say at 139.33. Here's 2.2% zone. This is where I'd like to see things get on the 30-year, and we can see that. Here's that speed bump that we're breaking through. A lot of shares traded right in this zone. 2.2 is where I think things really start to get matter. But how about we take a quick look at the dollar, and I want to look at gold mining stocks real quick. Dollar's threatening to move here. If you zoom out and you can see the 200-day moving average doesn't always act like a big level of resistance. It can blast through there. 94 is the next destination. Probably will set up a little bit there as sellers come back into play. After that, look for this thing to get going if the sellers can't get control of it. And we'll finish out with a little bit of GDX. And what do we have with GDX? A beautiful topping pattern forming as prices head down to 31. If we see gold miners continue to fall and bond prices rally, well, that is exactly what I'd be looking for. Thanks for being fans. Be sure to like. If you're not a subscriber, hey, you may want to consider it. Who knows? Anyways, I'm Steve Van Meter. I will look forward to seeing you on the Friday Macro Show. Bye now. The content of this video is provided as education information only. It's not intended to provide investment or other advice. Serial is not to be construed as recommendation or solicitation by our selling security, financial instrument, or to participate in particular trading strategies. We are was paired by Steam Van Meter. Personal capacity opinions expressed this video that do not reflect the value of Atlas Financial Advising or Steam Van Meter Financial.